Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. I do it for an audience of real entrepreneurs. I say that because you know what? Most people are not real entrepreneurs. I think being a founder now is a cool thing to do and to be. And so people call themselves entrepreneurs. They want to be entrepreneurs. And the truth is they're not. They don't really care. What they want is to feel like it. They want the outfit or the bit. There's no outfit or business card exactly. So instead, what they want is to be around it, and then they don't do jack. My audience, though, on the other hand, is actual doers, people who really are trying something, who are building something, who aspire to something bigger. Oof. And that aspiration feels great and also can be a little bit tough to deal with. And so I do these interviews to find out from people who are doing things, who are building impressive companies, to learn from them so that we can pull ideas from them and build our companies based on what we've learned. Today's guest is Michael Jackness. He is a guy who gave up poker, prostitutes. I don't know if you got anywhere near prostitutes. Got an opportunity to. We'll talk about that.
I did live in Costa Rica for a while, so I was near them.
Michael, when I ask you questions about that, you're going to have an opportunity to either be like safe or to be open. Safe or interesting. Safe or memorable. I hope you safe. Michael instead decided he was going to get into e-commerce. E-commerce! Which is exciting, but at the same time, so freaking dangerous, because there's someone out there who's giant, who's really doing good business, who can crush you, Amazon. And still, you're doing well. I want to find out how you're doing so well. I want to find out exactly how well you're doing. And a lot of what I'm going to ask you about is going to be based on the companies that you run at Terran. And also, you've documented it at Ecom Crew. So Michael Jackness, for completeness, he is the founder of Terran. It's an e-commerce conglomerate. They own a bunch of different e-commerce sites. They document their journey on ecomcrew.com, so you can see how they're building their businesses up. And we're going to find out here what he did to build up his e-com company, thanks to two phenomenal companies. The first will host your website, right? It's called HostGator. And the second will help you hire a great developer. It's called TopTal. Michael, right away, I'm going to ask you your revenue. How much money are you making right now?
Well, revenue is different than how much you're making, right? But revenue is $8 million. We'll do about $8 million this year with our e-commerce company. And net is going to be somewhere between 10 and 12%.
Okay. So you're almost at $1 million profit.
Yep.
Okay. And last year, did you make $1 million? Well, you know what? Let me ask you this. Were you able to put more than $1 million in the bank?
No. That's the great thing about e-commerce, is that you never put money in the bank. You just keep on putting it into more inventory. And when I say great thing, I'm being sarcastic. But no, it's definitely been a grind. It's been a learning experience, because when we were affiliate marketers, it was a totally different world. The money just came in and went right in the bank. But there's...
What's the most you ever saw in the bank at one shot?
In my personal bank account, I've had seven figures just sitting there in cash.
What is that? 2 million, 3 million, one?
Right around two. Yeah.
Right around two.
Yeah.
And that means that you've had to plow in more than $2 million into this.
Yeah. I mean, it's a long story, but I mean, this was back in 2008. We were in the middle of the online poker boom. The economy had just tanked. We had a bunch of cash. One of the things I did with it is I went and bought a house for cash. And then we eventually start buying domain names, which is how we got treadmill.com and how we got some of the other cool things, like we have tactical.com, graphicdesign.com, onlinedegree.com, a bunch of other domain names that we had purchased. Yep. We bought all those. And so we divested from cash and into other investments. But yeah, it's been a wild ride. At one point, I did have $2 million in cash sitting in the bank, which was interesting, that's for sure.
What do you mean by interesting? Take me to the high of it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting from the point of I kind of grew up in the typical American dream, or rat race of, you just, when you get more money, you want more things, and when you get more things, you want more money, and just keep on trying to go through this cycle. And
you know what? What's wrong with that cycle? I feel like that's a fine cycle. When you run, you want to do more running. That's fine. It's a great cycle. I ran it's been a while since I've run, because I've hurt myself, but I cycled last weekend 25 miles on Saturday. And I said, you know what? I want to do more. So I went to 35. It doesn't make me a bad person. What's wrong with wanting to accumulate more? Talk about it openly. What happened?
The thing that really changed me was when we lived in Costa Rica, and we had moved down there in 2006.
This is later on in the story, right?
This is in 2006. So
let me take it slow. I want to go back to your childhood. So you're saying, give me a sense of your childhood. I heard that your dad wasn't around much, right?
Well, I mean, he was there, but he's also an entrepreneur, and I think that's one of the downsides of being an entrepreneur.
What did he do?
He still does the same thing. He builds builds homes. He's like a custom home builder, cabinet builder.
Okay.
He was at work a lot. And so, I mean, he was there, but he wasn't necessarily present. And
did that bother you?
For sure. Yeah.
It's like, what's an example of a time that about really, it still bothers you that he doesn't see you now or that in your
job? We see each other now. Like, we don't live near each other anymore, but we talk to each other a lot more now. And I can tell that he probably regrets it a little bit. And,
was there like play or baseball game or something that he missed?
No,
all of them.
He just wasn't there. He wasn't home. He would come home at, 9 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, basically. And, saw very little of each other.
Okay.
And this is from, middle school and high school years. And in elementary school, he was around more. I have more fond memories of that. But, I get it. Like, I mean, it's hard. Like, I think that when I was younger, I didn't get it. You mentioned something in the beginning, like this is like a podcast for entrepreneurs. And unless you're like a real entrepreneur, you don't fully understand like what that means. And, you know, to use a poker term, you're all in, right? I mean, the real entrepreneur is really all in. And they're, and it's kind of almost a disease. I mean, your business kind of consumes you, and it very often a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with work-life balance and relationships and these types of things. And my dad was no exception. I mean, it wasn't like he was off at the racetrack or, drinking beers or, doing things that, society would like look down upon. He was trying to make a living and pay the bills to make sure I had a roof over my head. And I get that more now, but I was definitely, I regretted the fact that he wasn't around.
And still, when you were a kid, you're play acting and actually doing entrepreneurship.
What's
Discount Computer Consultants? How old were you when you started that?
I started that when I was 18. I did not go to college. I knew I wasn't going to college pretty early on. I think because my parents weren't around a lot, they weren't asking questions of how you doing in school, making sure my homework was done, making sure that I was going to go to college. That never, ever came up. I don't know if it's an inherent trait or what it is that, makes you kind of a street fighter and just, that you're going to figure out a way to make money. And, I was fortunate that I grew up, in the 80s, mostly in the early 90s. And when computers were like just kind of coming to be, and that was my hobby. And also like, it was cool, like to be playing video games on a computer, on a PC and that stuff at that time. So that became... I knew that I had a skill that a lot of people around me didn't have, and that they were willing to pay for. So that became my first business.
Your first business was fixing people's computers. I heard with $200, you bought yourself some business cards. You bought yourself a pager so that you could be weak to fix people's computers. You were off and running, didn't go to college. Then one of your clients hired you to do what? Full time. Yeah,
one of my clients was when I first started the company, I was doing just home computer stuff, and then at some point, I ran into a guy that had a consulting business doing corporate stuff. So I started kind of getting into some corporate stuff, and then eventually, one of those companies offered me a job, and I took the job.
And you spent 7 years there, and it seems like you might have been a little bit bored because you were playing poker on the side at the time.
Well, poker was a big thing back then. I mean, this was, I took the job in 1998, 97, 98. And I wasn't bored the first 5 years because the company was growing really fast. And even though I was hired as the director of IT, I became the youngest executive at the company, and I started getting in a bunch of other areas of the company. And it was really fun. I really enjoyed my time there. I was getting paid very well, and I enjoyed my work immensely. And poker was just something that I did as a hobby. I was playing poker up in Atlantic City. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, so I was in Atlantic City. I was up there visiting my grandma and playing poker a lot there, playing online poker. I had tournaments in my house, and eventually came across the fact that affiliate marketing was a thing, and that became the next business.
Because you were bored playing poker too, because back then you could only play one game at a time.
Right.
I didn't even realize it was a period there where you couldn't have multiple games going at a time.
And this is like very beginning of online poker. So I mean, it was one window that now you could play like 12 tables at once. But back then, it was boring as hell.
And it was incredibly popular, and they were constantly eager for more players. You saw they had a link to an affiliate program on their site. You hit the affiliate program link. You see that they pay a few bucks per person. What do they pay? Do you still remember?
I remember it like it was yesterday. It's so I can barely remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but some things you remember like really well. But the page said, if you send us 1 to 9 players a month, we'll pay you $65 a player. And if you pay, send us 10 or more, we'll pay you 75. And then when I had emailed them a month later, asking them is what I'm doing okay? Is this against your terms of service? Are you okay with, you know, how I'm sending you players? And is there room to get paid anymore? They responded back, we're completely fine with what you're doing. And if you send us 200 players or more per month, we'll pay you $200 per player.
Whoa. And did you get to that level?
I did in the first month that we got to 1,000 actually.
Because of what you did. Tell people how you got members.
So we created, from what I know, as far as I know, was the very first like incentivized marketing to be done on the internet. And again, this is 2004. And my thought was, you know, I'm a pretty introverted guy. I mean, I had a small group of close friends, so I wasn't going to make a living out of getting just my friends to sign up. And I was like, how can I get hundreds or thousands of people to sign up? And I was like, I'll give away a set of poker chips if you sign up under my link. So we incentivized them to use our link, and then I sent them a set of poker chips in exchange, and we made about in the very beginning, we made about $110 per customer who signed up under that. And like I said, in the very first month, we did over 1,000.
That's unreal. How did you know that they really actually signed up? One of the problems with incentivizing a third-party offer was you couldn't keep track of whether people really signed up or not.
So because we had communicated with the room and made sure that it was okay to be doing that, and I saw that being a problem in the very beginning, I asked them if they would verify for me. So the process was they would go sign up, they make a deposit, and then they would email us and say that we did this, here's my screen name, and then I would email the poker room and ask them to verify that they did do that. And then pretty quickly they started sending like a daily update of a spreadsheet of all the people that were signed up under us so we could verify it ourselves, so we would leave that alone.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. All right. Making a lot of money at the height. How much money did you bring in from that?
Yeah, I mean, we had a nine-figure company at one point. It was pretty crazy. I mean, we were making
profit. Nine figures over $100 million?
Oh, sorry, eight figures. What the hell am I talking about?
So over $10 million.
Sorry, yes, 10 million. Sorry. No, not 100 million. I'm losing track. I think maybe the cold medicine's got into my head.
A lot of figures. But over $10 million coming into you, and the most you saw in the bank was $2 million.
Well, I had some partners, and we also don't forget we had expenses. It wasn't
right. You had to buy ads to get people to come.
Yeah, we had, you know, and we were really aggressive with this. But I mean, that's, you know, we asked how much I had in cash in the bank at one time. I mean, so, you know, that was cash. There was obviously other things we had going on. I mean, it was a crazy ride. I mean, to me, you know, growing up relatively poor, it was, you know, a ton of money. And I had been fortunate that this was not the first time I had run into some money. So I was pretty conservative and saved a lot more than everyone else around me. Most of the people you were talking about, prostitutes earlier, there was that, and drugs. And
you saw that because, I'm looking here at my notes. You said, you know what? It was spending ridiculous money, prostitutes, and treating people like less than. That's what this online poker world was like.
Yeah.
You were, give me the most ridiculous, over the top night. If they were going to make it into a movie, this is what they would put in the trailer.
Well, they did make a movie. The movie was highly inaccurate.
What was the movie?
I think Runner Runner is what it was called, right? It was about
Runner Runner.
Yeah, I think that's the name of it. It was like a Ben Affleck. I only watched it once. It was a long time ago, but it was, you know, it was loosely around this. But I saw someone drive a car into a pole just to show off one time that they could do the most ridiculous thing. That was
really. It was just, let me show you that I can burn money. I'm going to crash my car here. When a poor college student who cracks an online poker game goes bust, he arranges a face to face with the man he thinks created him, a sly offshore entrepreneur. This is based on that world.
That might not be the right name of the movie. That might not be the right movie, man. I thought that was what it was called, but maybe it was.
It could just be that IMDb has got a really.
I think that might have been the movie, and it was based on, you know, loosely on that whole Costa Rican absolute poker ultimate bet scene, but maybe not. Maybe that's why the movie didn't seem like it was it was too accurate.
Wait, why'd you end up in Costa Rica?
So we were living in Vegas, which was kind of the center of the poker world at the time.
Because you were playing poker.
We were playing poker. Our business was about poker. We weren't just like your typical affiliate. We had also created like a poker news organization. So we were at the World Series every year. And we were documenting poker. We were trying to build a legitimate business around.
What was the website? I'm going to go archive.org, the business.
It's still there. It's Poker News Daily. We sold it to someone, and they're still running it to this day, as far as I know.
Okay.
Poker News Daily, we had press passes for the World Series, and we were there until the wee hours in the morning often. and did a lot of interviews with players, and we were pretty connected with that world.
Okay. You had a lot of girlfriends?
I had one girlfriend, my wife. I was already married.
And you didn't get to experience any of this?
Well, I mean, it's probably good because I think I'd be dead.
Really, Jackie Martling from the Howard Stern Show basically said to me, don't ask me that. And I said, come on, you were dating other people. You were on the Howard Stern Show at its height. He goes, you know what? I didn't. But if I did, I would lie to you about it. And I go, I think I get it. Would you lie to me about it if you did? If you were sleeping
probably, but I am actually being honest in this case that okay. I have been 100% faithful to
doesn't
my wife.
Doesn't that suck? That doesn't bother you? Like you finally get this attention, this money, this lifestyle, and you don't get to be a part of it? You didn't resent any part of it?
I did at the time. I'm not going to lie. Like there was definitely a time when I did, but looking back at it, I really do believe I would be dead. I think I would have got sucked into it like everyone else. I think the thing that kept me from getting in a lot of trouble was because I was married and, you know, there was a lot of things I said no to and just didn't go to prevent myself from being, it's so easy to be sucked into it. Like, I don't care what people say. I mean, like when you're around other people that are acting a certain way, like they're your peer group, it's very difficult not to get sucked into that. Cause like, I mean, it's like adult peer pressure and you see people dressing a certain way, wearing certain things, driving certain things, going to certain hotels or restaurants. And I mean, you want to do the same thing and it's that feels good for a certain amount of time, but that wears off very quickly. I mean, it's like that dopamine hit becomes less and less every time. So, you know, I think that, you know, I probably would have, you know, ended up doing drugs or, you know, other things that luckily I just didn't get into. And I know that I'm compulsive and, it, you know, I would be like the best cocaine addict that's ever been alive. And
no, I'm compulsive too. I'm glad I don't get into coke or drugs because I'm now into coffee to excess. It's just unreal.
Yeah.
And I started with soda, Dr. Pepper all of a sudden. And
at least it's diet. I saw it.
Sorry?
I said, at least it's diet, right? It just looked like a diet.
It's no, it doesn't help with anything. But I find that life, unless there's a lot going on, I find that it's just too boring. Do you find that too? You seem like you're okay with it now.
It's interesting you say that because yes, sometimes yes. But you know, I think that over those years of living in Costa Rica, seeing the way other people were acting, knowing now that they're all broke and destitute, like, I mean, they have nothing because they just spent to excess. But also, you know, you're around people that are making $600 a month, that are working 12-hour days, 6 days a week. And what I realized is they were just happier than me. You don't notice it for the first few months or even year necessarily. But after a while, you know, I was down there, I wasn't really happy with a lot of things. But these guys were like always smiling and super happy. And I just, you know, eventually kind of put two and two together. You realize it isn't the money that necessarily is going to make. I mean, there's definitely, and I've read a lot of books about this now and talk to people about it. And there's like this whole curve where like, you know, money to a certain point, like is a huge factor. I mean, if you can't pay your electric bill, your mortgage, your car payments, whatever, and that's all you're ever worrying about, then, you know, I'd be foolish to say that that isn't a factor. But like after a certain point, and that, you know, the number is different depending on where you live. Some people say 80,000, some people say up to 150,000, that there's a diminishing returns on your happiness to the money curve. And I really believe that. Like, I think that that's very, very true.
Now, I still think the more the better for me, but I get it. I understand it intellectually.
I'm not going to turn it away. I don't have an endless pursuit for it anymore like I did before.
Costa Rica, how'd you end up there?
Well, I mean, because I had an endless pursuit for money, quite frankly, like I said, I mean, my objectives and everything in life were different then. And we moved there to save on paying taxes was like one of the number one objectives. We, as a U.S. citizen, you still have to pay tax on your worldwide income, but we set up a legal tax structure to get that down to about 11%, is what we were paying. And so, I mean, completely legally. I mean, we paid all of our tax bills. This is something I'd tell the IRS if they were sitting in front of me right now. We did nothing that
What's the legal structure that allows you to only pay 11% taxes when you're an American citizen?
Yep. So this is at the time, you know, this does not exist anymore. But this was under the Bush tax cut era, if you remember back to the mid-2000s. So we had a Australian company that was, you know, Australia is a treaty country to the United States for these tax treaties. And we also had a Panama company. So the Australian company like was just a holding company, and we paid ourselves basically a salary that was right around what the exemption is. So there's about 100 and something thousand dollars a year you can get paid per person. So my wife and I both took a salary and paid zero taxes on that exemption part. And that exemption still exists today. And then...
Meaning whatever you take as a salary up to a reasonable limit, you don't have to pay any taxes on.
Well, the limits is very black and white, and it changes every year. It goes up a little bit. But at the time, I think it was like 88,500, if I remember correctly. I think now it's about 100,000. So anyone who lives abroad, that lives in, like, say, a tax-free jurisdiction, just as a for instance, up to the first 100,000-ish of income, there is no taxes. Like, this still exists. You have to be it's called a bona fide resident of another country. So that took some time to establish that residency. But on that first, let's say, just roughly 100K of income, there were no taxes. And then the Australian company, and again, we were living abroad, fully living abroad. The entire company was abroad. We had no presence or business in the United States. We were not trying to skirt any of that. We weren't allowed to visit the United States more than 35 days a year, I believe was the total number, to be able to qualify for that tax treatment. And then the company paid all of our distributions as a dividend. And back then, dividends were taxed at 15%. So by the time you add up like all our full blended income, it was around 11%
taxes. Got it.
And we were able to do that because it was a foreign company operating, you know, outside the United States with all non-US employees. We didn't have US customers and stuff like that. So that's how we were able to do it at the time.
Olivia, why am I living in San Francisco, one of the most highly taxed cities in the world? What are we doing here?
Yeah, I mean,
to go somewhere else.
So I mean, I've been through that.
I love that you went into detail on this. This is, I think, what separates Mixergy from other places. I want the detail. I think for most people, it's going to go over their heads. They're going to get bored. They don't care. I want that detail. I want to know that this is out there. And yes, today that may not be exactly the same option. That may not actually exist the same way, but I want us to know that there are options like that. All right, let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor and then get back into the story. All right, my first sponsor is a company called TopTal. If you're listening to me, you're a person who does not like to be limited. You want, like, look at this. Look at what Michael's been able to do with his life. And you guys are going to hear even more. And doesn't it suck when you have an idea and you say, you know what, we don't have the technical resources for it. We don't have the bandwidth. Our team is overtaxed. Well, you know what? It doesn't have to be that way. We had that situation. What you do is you go to TopTal and you say, look, TopTal, I want you to impress me. Impress me. Here's what I need. Here's my problem. Here's the way we work. Can you please find somebody to do this? And if they don't find the right person, you're under no obligation. It's not like you pay for a bunch of ads or you pay for a recruiter. There's none of that. You just call them up. You tell them what you're looking for. And yeah, they want to make sure that you're a real business, not just someone who has a fantasy idea and is looking for someone to build it for you on the cheap. But if that's you, if you really have a real business, you have a real need for an individual to work full-time or part-time or a team of people to work together, there's no better place to hire developers right now than at TopTal. So just go to this URL where you're going to get the deal that you've heard me say so much. You can probably repeat it with me. The URL is toptal.com/Mixergy. T-O-P. Have you ever used that, Michael?
I have not, but I'm going to definitely check it out.
File it away. You're going to be upset one time. Someone's going to say no to you, and you're going to say, you know what? That guy, Andrew, pain in the ass, but he was honest about all this other stuff. Let's just try this TopTal thing and see if he's full of it or not. And then you're going to go to toptal.com/Mixergy. You're probably going to forget the /Mixergy. And when you do forget the /Mixergy, you're going to miss out on the fact that they're going to give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit. When you pay for 80 hours, you're going to miss out on the fact that they're going to give you this this guarantee. But you're still going to love them because they give you high quality people. And for those of you who are listening to me, don't miss out. Write it down. toptal.com/Mixergy. toptal.com/Mixergy. All right, let's continue with the story. You are now in Costa Rica, saving money, doing this well. At some point, does online poker things start to crash?
So it's actually kind of crazy how things work out. We moved, we had bought the place that we were going to move to in like June of 2006. I got married in August 2006. We came back from our honeymoon in September 2006 and went to a conference in Vegas. Drove to Houston, flew to Costa Rica to move down there, and 3 days later, the UIGA passed, which is the Unlawful Gaming Enforcement Act. So we were down there 3 days before like the crap hit the fan.
And you know what? I have to give it to them. A lot of people who are gambling were becoming degenerates, online gambling, and this one law really did stop it. You thought the internet can't be stopped. It's a worldwide thing. No, it can't be stopped. You thought that, let people do whatever they want. And you know what? I'm a let people do whatever they want type of person too. But I gotta hand it to them. This thing worked, right?
It actually didn't work.
It didn't work? What was the law then that worked? What's the one where I saw my brother play poker all day long and then suddenly a law came down and he goes, I can't play it anymore.
So the law, what ended up happening was it made it illegal for companies to process credit card payments is what the law, because I think they had to be careful about like how, what they made illegal or not, because the World Trade Organization would like come down on them for blocking stuff that's legal in another jurisdiction, which the WTO ultimately did come down on the United States for doing this. In the United States, in their infinite wisdom, just like gave the WTO the middle finger, because that's what the United States does. They like to push their weight around when they want to, but they don't listen to these types of rulings. But what ended up happening was the publicly traded companies that were operating in the United States at the time, which were Party Poker and Pacific Poker, 888, and a couple others, they pulled out of the United States when the law passed because they were publicly traded in the UK. And they couldn't take a chance of operating in a jurisdiction where it was no longer legal. But these other companies, you know, PokerStars, Absolute Poker, Ultimate Bet, Full Tilt Poker, et cetera, continued to operate in the United States for many more years past that. And the ultimate thing that brought them down was another big day, and there's a whole bunch of other things that happened in between, but the government eventually seized four of those companies' assets and shut them down.
Okay, so it was the seizures that stopped them. All right, so you get back to the U.S., the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act of 2006 comes down. How does it affect your business?
Well, we were living in Costa. We had just moved to Costa Rica in that time, so it affected our business immensely.
I see. Okay, Costa Rica.
Yeah. So I mean, we were there from 2006 to 2009. Then we ended up moving to the Cayman Islands for a year. Lived there for a year in 2010. And yeah, I mean, the business at that point was like this. Before the UIGA passed, was like this hockey stick growth, and then it was just like you just take the hockey stick and flip it upside down. It was right kind of into the ground. But I don't know how much you want to talk about this part of my life, but there were some other interesting things that kind of happened here. We did experience some growth from a top line perspective. That's when we were able to hit the eight figures, but we had more expenses because what we ended up doing was partnering with some people, that were based in the United States at the time, that there was so much uncertainty. They didn't know how to operate their business anymore. So they basically gave the business to us and we operated it and gave them, a part of the revenue, like indefinitely.
What was the business?
The other poker affiliate stuff.
So, and you were still able to do well with online affiliate?
We were, because we were living in Costa Rica. We had a foreign company that was based in Australia, so we were able to move money around and do it legally because we weren't based in the United States.
And when you got back to the U.S., they didn't stop you. They didn't arrest you. None of that.
No. I mean, we never did anything illegal. Like even. Tiptoeing over the line, because we weren't operating an online poker room. We were an affiliate. We were advertisers for these rooms. We weren't the one thing that was illegal to do was to process financial institutions to enable people to do gaming payments.
What got you to finally stop all that?
I had had enough by 2010. So I stepped aside. I still own part of the company for many years after that. I actually just got out of it this year finally. But from an operational standpoint and having anything to do with it in any way, shape, or form, I walked away at the end of 2010.
Because you just had enough.
I had enough. I mean, some of the stuff I was alluding to, I mean, mostly the people that, you know, you think of all the stereotypes that you would think of when you think of online gaming and those types of people, like that's the majority of the people that were in the industry. And I just did not enjoy being around those people. I didn't want to, you know, they were enablers for other, you know, other things that I just didn't want to be around. And I left. We went back to the U.S. We bought an RV and RV'd for 2 years.
Just because you needed to get away.
Basically, I at the time I thought I would retire.
Did you have enough money to retire?
We did. Yeah, yeah.
You did. You know that book, Ben Mezrich had a book about the guys who decided that they were going to get into online poker. They built a whole poker website. It's called Straight Flush. That was a fascinating book, but I see what you're talking about. When there's unlimited money, you're kind of getting out of the U.S., avoiding U.S. laws. You start to go to excess, and that's what you're saying.
I wasn't avoiding U.S. laws. I want to make sure that I don't want the government like hearing this and thinking.
But I feel like
I was definitely not. It was not that was never the reason we moved down there. We moved down there well before the UIGA. Well, we had started making that process happen before that passed. We did not move down there because of any laws. We were moving down there for a favorable tax.
I meant the people who are in the space, but I'm glad that you...
For sure. The people that were around us, that some of them ultimately who did go to jail, they were breaking the law and they knew it. And we knew they were breaking the law, but we weren't. So there was, that was their decision.
When you were in the RV, is that when you got into domaining?
It is. Yeah, we came back. We had that cash that was around. And, my mind starts to wander pretty quickly. I think that's, again, it's a disease like anything else, entrepreneurism. And, I wanted to get into quote unquote more legitimate businesses at that point. Not that online poker wasn't, it's just that there was definitely like a negative connotation around what we were doing for sure. Even you just said it, people like online were gambling a lot or losing money, et cetera. And that you thought it wasn't good. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that, but there's a negative connotation around it that I just didn't want to be associated with anymore. And that's when we started buying these domain names.
Graphicdesign.com, websitehosting.com, cuttingboard.com, yep. wordpressthemes.com. You mentioned treadmill.com,
yep.
And onlinestores.com. You had all of those. What were you planning to do with them?
So it was part investment just because I felt like .com single word or two word names were that had a lot of exact match search volume were going to always be in demand. And I was definitely right about that. I definitely had it wasn't really that big of a revelation. This is now 2010. I mean, the internet had been around for a long time. It wasn't shocking, but these names are still, since we bought them, have continued to appreciate and become worth more. So we definitely made the right decision there. As far as what I plan on doing with them, at the time when I first started buying them, I thought either A, I would just buy them as investments, or B, turn them into some other type of affiliate type marketing website. What ended up happening after running treadmill.com for a few months as an affiliate website, I was out on a hike one day and I started just, kind of having some soul searching. And I was like, what I'm doing here is like kind of like bottom feeding. I'm adding zero value to the world. I'm basically deceiving people, not necessarily immorally, but like certainly where I'm not proud of it. They're coming to my website, like there's a thin content like review of a treadmill. The ones that's ranked higher is probably the one that pays me more. The FTC eventually ended up coming down on all this years later because people were taking it too far. And I think that was the right decision on their part, honestly. But we were years ahead of this. And I was like, instead of doing this, I want to run a legitimate business. I want to sell the treadmills. And that's when we got into e-commerce. And
it's more sustainable. It's the type of thing that you can pass on to someone else. You can sell it. You can build it up, have it run without you. Okay. Exactly. So that's where you were. And you said, I'm going to start to sell treadmills. So you got the treadmill companies?
Yeah, yeah, we like literally picked up.
Thank you.
I called the front desk.
Sales.
Yeah, I mean, no, I called the front desk. Like, asked for like the VP of sales. Or
did you really? This is how you did it.
Swear to God. Yeah.
And they didn't actually say thank you. What did they say instead?
Well, it was interesting. You can kind of draw a line down the middle of the industry. So you have one side of the industry that was pretty accepting of us, and that was kind of the very commercialized, commoditized treadmill. So like the stuff you would find at Sports Authority or Walmart, the sub $1,500, really sub $1,000 treadmill market. And not only was I competing against Walmart and Sports Authority, but also against the manufacturer themselves. So, but they were accepting of us. The other side, the specialty market, your $3,000 to $5,000 pieces of equipment, they were initially responsive to us, but then eventually very quickly shut us down because there was a very legacy brick and mortar component to it where, an individual store had a territory and they were pissed that we were potentially stealing their sales. And they band together and all those specialty retailers where all the money was to be made in this business, told us thanks, but no thanks, which was crazy to me.
And so they didn't want you to sell. And I guess I kind of understand it because it's hard to get people to buy treadmills online, right?
It is and it isn't. I mean, it definitely is.
If they're going to pick one online or offline, it seems like offline would still be the better one for them to bet on.
You'd be surprised. I mean,
really?
Yeah. I mean, we sold over $1 million worth of stuff our first year. We didn't know what the hell we were even doing. And
just because of the domain, because people would type in treadmill.com.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's crazy. I know it sounds nuts.
And then how much affiliate money were you making if they were typing in treadmill.com? And
well, we weren't doing it as an affiliate at that point. We were doing it as a drop shipper, as an actual store. And the margins were thin. I mean, the margin, that was ultimately, you know, when I started to understand the business, and because I really knew nothing about it, this is typical Mike Jackness MO. I'll go into something 2 feet in, all in, without all knowledge. I feel like I'll out hustle everyone else and do a better job that way. But it definitely backfired on me. Like that, the stuff I was up against these things were not solvable.
What were you up against? People weren't, you weren't able to get the right treadmills. Okay. What else?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say it was a few things. Number one, I was competing against the Walmarts and the sports authorities of the world, and they didn't listen to MAP pricing at all. So like, but the manufacturers forced us to stay with MAP pricing. So we were at a pricing disadvantage. We had no control over the product. We were a drop shipper. So like we would take an order for a treadmill and we would submit the order and find out later that it was out of stock. So we'd have egg on our face and have to go back to the customer and figure out a way to get around that. We couldn't dictate how quickly the thing got out the door and how quickly we got a tracking number. This is an age where people want a tracking number within 1 to 2 days. And that just wasn't able to happen. It would get on the back of a tractor trailer or truck. It was not going UPS because it was too heavy. And these people do not deliver on time. You know, UPS is pretty damn reliable. FedEx is pretty reliable, but common carrier, not so much. So, you know, it would show up. The guy would take a half a day off of work and no one would ever show up or call et cetera. Oh, it was horrible. And we get the phone call. You know, it's like, I demand that you pay me for my half a day of work. And now I got to come back, you know. And then, or the thing
had the phone number at the top of your website back then too. So it was easy for them to,
we took the phone call. We took all the phone calls. It was awful. So after 2 years of dealing with all that, and I tried everything. I mean, it's crazy. I even, we at one point had flown up to Logan, Utah, which is where the majority of the stuff is made, looked at buying a warehouse across the street from where it was made. Like they were willing to like drive the stuff across the street on a forklift and put it in our warehouse to where we would ship it so we can get it out quicker. I even looked at like creating our own shipping network and stuff to try to get stuff there on time. But like the reality is that that's just not possible. Like, I mean, I can't create a nationwide shipping network. That's like that's a $1 billion problem. And at the end of the day, we just couldn't solve it.
And this was you and your friend, Michael Kupfer, who now runs, what is it? Chicago Signs.
Yeah. He's doing a bunch of other e-commerce stuff. And Grant, my buddy Grant, also the three of us were the ones doing it at the time. And, eventually we kind of just all conceded with our tail between our legs that we weren't going to solve these problems. And it was a business that was making money and generating revenue, but like I wasn't happy. Like, I mean, and again, like the money isn't like the number one thing for me. So, I mean, when because I was the one that was responsible for taking the phone calls. And when I realized that there wasn't anything I could do to dictate like the people calling us being happy people, they were always going to be mad. And it was out of my control to fix that. We threw the towel in.
All right, before we move on past it, one thing that worked for you especially well at treadmill.com that we can learn from if we're selling anything online, if we're doing e-commerce specifically.
I mean, I think the thing that I learned during that time was how to deal with good customer service, you know, how to be empathetic and just make people happy. As close to at all costs as you get in a business. So you can't, you know, just give them a free $1,000 treadmill. But the thing I really learned during those days was that I'll throw another thing in there. You can't make up like low margin or negative profitable sales with volume, right? It's like you just making less money more times, making less money. So I mean, like what really was happening was like a lot of it I was equating back to the whole like poker CPA day. So I was like, oh, I'm selling this $2,000 treadmill, even though it's only 10 points of profit, I'm still making $200. And that's like, that's the same as a poker CPA. Like that's literally how I was thinking.
Ah, right. All this really work stupid, to sell one treadmill and it's just the equivalent of one guy signing up for a Poker Stars account. Right.
Exactly. That's- yeah. And then out of that, unlike in poker, now I had to take ads and infrastructure and credit card processing fee and all these other things out of that. And it just wasn't feasible. It wasn't really like the business that I thought it was going to be when I first got into it.
Okay, let me talk about my second sponsor, and then we'll get into how you actually started to find your mojo in e-commerce. My second sponsor is a company called HostGator. Let me ask you something. If someone's listening to us and they want to sell something using, or actually, if all I gave them was a WordPress hosted site on HostGator, and they had nothing else, what would you suggest that they start off with?
It's interesting. I used to work with HostGator a lot, so now we're talking my language. Well, I used to own websitehosting.com, which you talked about, and HostGator was one of my best affiliates, and I also had all of my stuff hosted on HostGator. It's a great platform because they're really cheap, and they can like launch WordPress websites like really quickly.
Yeah.
Which
is there
awesome.
An idea for a WordPress website that you could imagine if you were just starting out, if you're that 18-year-old kid not going to college, you decide, you know what, all I got is the ability to publish online. What would you publish today in 2018?
It's funny you ask this. I just had this conversation with one of my best friends last week in Vegas. I think I'm going to do this actually moving forward again, because I used to do this at mikejackness.com, but I've kind of abandoned it. But I think if you document your life, if you got something interesting going on, your personal hobbies and passions to others will be interesting to other people who have those same hobbies and passion, whether it's scuba diving or traveling or foodies or cooking or whatever it is.
Just document your experience with whatever it is, and then where's the revenue coming from?
Well, I mean, traffic is revenue, right? So, I mean, and in some cases, if you're blogging about how to save money for investing or something, that's going to bring you more revenue down the road because that stuff pays more.
Right.
If you're blogging about your passion, it'll always be effortless and never seem like work. And if you're lucky enough to be able to layer that and mirror that over something that is on the scope of things that pays more, because affiliate revenue is higher in certain categories, you know, credit cards, insurance, investing, online degrees, and, you know, education.
Where would you get the affiliate programs that today? What's a good spot for them?
Like Commission Junction has
CJ.com.
Yeah, they're a good place to start looking. But just doing a search of, you'd be surprised. Like, I mean, if you're in a niche that whatever niche you're in, you just start looking on their own websites and just look for the word affiliate on the bottom of their page. A lot of the companies have affiliate links right on their website. So that's just exactly how I got started with Party Poker. And, I wish I did more of that and stuck with it, because what ends up happening, just like everyone else, a lot of people are really into it for the first 6 to 12 months, and they give up on it too soon. And it really takes 2 to 3 years of like just constant pressure forever, like really working on it. And that's what we've done with Econ Crew. Like, I really stuck at it with this over the last few years. I mean, we're at like 190 podcast episodes now, and we've put hundreds of articles on Econ Crew. You know, the first year we were talking to ourselves. You know, you're writing to yourself and talking to yourself, because until you hit that hockey stick growth. And I think that if you have a personal interest like I have with e-commerce, and you're talking about something that you live and breathe, other people will find that to be interesting.
That's good advice from a person who's actually generated money, not somebody who's a la-di-da, go create your love and follow your passion. You actually have a business sense, and you're still saying, find that topic that you're most excited about, document your experience with it, and then start looking for affiliate programs. And I think affiliate programs are a great way to start, because they let you test the water on selling something that isn't directly related to you, but related to your topic, to see whether people are interested enough to buy it. And then if it works, then you could create your own version of it. So I can imagine somebody who's into scuba diving might do an affiliate program for a scuba event or for a course or for something, see if that works.
Then for travel, like, you know, flights and hotels and things like that, you got
to
get.
That's a really hard one to make money on, though.
It is tough.
Affiliate commission is pretty low. You got to find a better affiliate program. But searching for affiliate programs is still a good way to generate sales. Take your idea to hostgator.com/mixergy. They'll give you a super low price. You'll be tagged as a Mixergy person, which means they're going to take especially good care of you, because I know that we stand behind all of our listeners. HostGator.com/Mixergy. All right. Treadmills was not the answer. You went to a site called, was it Biz Buy Sell? I never even heard of them.
Yeah. They're still around, still pretty big.
What'd you do with them?
So when we sold Treadmill.com in January 2015, mm-hmm. we had one employee that was working for us at Treadmill.com. And for any entrepreneurs out there listening, you know, like, really good employees are hard to find. And I did not want to let this guy go. I felt like I can build another business around him, just because he was reliable and did a really good job and understood e-commerce at this point. And I understood e-commerce at this point. And I wanted to do more with e-commerce. So I had another whole set of criteria now at this point. Like I learned all these mistakes of running treadmill.com. So now I wanted like small, light, easy to ship products that didn't have a shelf life, that didn't have a new model every year. Cause like it's a pain in the ass. Like you spent all this time and energy creating content, video content and picture content. We fly out to the manufacturers and take all the, you know, all these videos and photos of the equipment. And then 9 to 12 months later, it was obsolete because they come up with a new model. So like these are all things that I took into consideration. And I was looking for any other e-commerce business that kind of like fit these criteria. And I found icereps.com.
And so you bought it for how much?
Bought it for $50,000.
And they had sales, they had customer lists, the whole thing.
Had been around for 7 years. They were not doing well. They had kind of run into the ground.
You know? What platform were they on?
At the time, they were on Yahoo Stores.
Okay, so that's a mistake. What other mistakes did you, as you saw them, did you notice that they had that allowed you to straighten the company out?
Yeah, I mean, I think my hypothesis was that the platform was the biggest issue because I'm an SEO guy that, you know, I've been doing SEO for a long time. And I would look at like SEMrush or one of these types of tools and I saw their traffic just kind of going off the cliff. And I was like, you know what, if I get this thing off of Yahoo Stores and just redo the content, it should bounce back. And it did. And it ranked really well for a long time. And then we switched from BigCommerce to Shopify and it's gone down over the last year, which is really frustrating.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. It doesn't have much traffic and that's what it is.
It doesn't need a lot of traffic because it's like highly motivated buyers. You know,
it's all search. The 70% search, 30% direct according to SimilarWeb.
Yeah. And so, I mean, like the things that we do get traffic for, the conversion rate's off the charts. But what ended up evolving was a big Amazon business. Like the sales that we have on icereps.com now pale in comparison to that brand's sales on amazon.com.
So for a long time, people were searching for ice wraps because they're runners, they're athletes, they need some ice. They buy it, you ship it to them. You personally would ship it, or was it still drop? You would ship it out to them. SEO was what got traffic to the door. What else got customers?
Yeah, I mean, it was all search traffic, all organic search traffic.
Do you do anything else? Any interesting marketing? It was writing posts. It seems like you're big on posting.
Yeah, I mean, we wrote articles about, you know, tennis elbow, or, you know, should you use hot or cold therapy, things of this nature. But the vast majority of it was people typing in like wrist ice pack. We ranked number one at the time. Now we're like number five-ish for a lot of the terms. We've fallen backwards, which is frustrating.
Here's one of the search terms that you guys are big for. How long for knee? What is this? How long for knee swelling to go down?
Right.
So that's
running content about that, which definitely helps. But if you look for things like knee ice wrap or wrist ice pack or shoulder ice wrap, those are other terms that we rank for. And the search volume and the traffic isn't necessarily super high, but like the conversion rate is off the charts because it's people that are looking to solve that problem like right now.
Why do you think that switching to Shopify hurt you guys?
Shopify and BigCommerce are both great platforms. There's a long debate we can get into about both of these. It's kind of like the beta and VHS wars of the 80s, right? Back when videotape was a thing. Beta was better, but VHS won. And I think that, you know, BigCommerce from a technical standpoint is actually better in a lot of ways, but Shopify has won because they're bigger and there's a bigger ecosystem. We had other businesses that we set up on Shopify in our company. Now that we're like an $8 million company with a bunch of employees, we wanted to standardize everything. And the reason specifically that Shopify isn't as good as BigCommerce for SEO is because of their URL structure. So you go from having mywebsite.com/product to having mywebsite.com/shop/collection/product. So it makes
sense. I see it. So yeah. I'm on one of the ice wraps. The URL is icewraps.com/collection/icewraps/product/ and then the name with hyphen. Yeah,
it's ridiculous. And like, it's ridiculous.
It's just not as good for SEO.
Yep.
Okay. So you started with one. What was the next step once this thing worked? What else did you do?
So icewraps turned into a 7-figure company within the first year. I mean, it did really well. But we started learning more there. You know, it's like just life's a learning process and journey. So we had taken everything we learned from treadmill, applied it to ice wraps. And then as we were in that world, we learned a couple more things. They were subtle. Number one, we didn't want to sell other people's products anymore. We wanted to sell our own. We wanted more control. Number two, we wanted products that people were passionate about, because word of mouth advertising with ice wraps is really tough. You're not going to go, oh my God, honey, like I put this thing in the freezer and it got cold. Like that's, it's not really that exciting. You don't necessarily share your aches and pains with somebody else and how you solve that stuff. That's kind of one of these things that's just private amongst most people. The coloring, as a for instance, is something people love to share. And I don't get it because I don't color, but you know, people that are in the coloring as a hobby, they love sharing their drawings and talking about this stuff. And it did really well. It was also, we were riding a wave as well.
What do you mean by coloring? Like coloring books for adults.
Yeah,
coloring books for adults. That was becoming a really big thing. So yeah. You guys got Color It. That was your site?
Yeah, we bought colorit.com, created our own coloring books, our own gel pens, markers, pencils, and you know, use that passion angle. And the fact that there was a Facebook audience that we could advertise that those products to, and built another seven-figure brand out of it.
I'm going to color. I have a typo. Colorit.com. You guys hired someone to create the blank coloring books.
Yep.
How did you know what to do since you're not in the space?
I'm pretty resourceful. I mean, I looked at other stuff that was out there, and my thing, you know, I took it back to the days of when we were doing online poker, and it was, you know, I didn't want to just copy everybody else. I wanted to create something that was new and unique. So I looked at, you know, we spent many months looking at the industry, and basically at the time, everyone was making their books on the same presses that you would make a Stephen King paperback novel on. Mm-hmm. Not the best paper or the size footprint of a book to make a coloring book out of. So I was like, you know what, we're going to make a book with a hardback cover that's going to make it so people can color in their lap and protect their artwork. We're going to print single-sided, so when you color, it doesn't ruin the backside of the page. We're going to perforate the pages so you can take them out of the book and be able to gift them or frame them. We're going to make a spiral binding so the book will lie flat and not constantly be trying to close on itself when you're coloring. And all this stuff had never been done before. You know, now you look around and it's all done, but we made a very unique and better product.
Michael, that's a high level of empathy with a customer that you don't personally relate to. I just spent an hour talking to Seth Godin about empathy and understanding customers and how tough that is and how most businesses won't do it. You did it. How? Were you calling up people who are, when you say resourceful, walk me through that. What did you do that told you this is the new product that you should be creating?
I mean, some of that stuff seemed obvious to me. I would say half of it was just like, obviously, like it doesn't make sense to have you know, because I would buy the competitor's book and look at it, and like, this is dumb. Like you, it's like this thin paper, and as soon as you take a marker to it, it bleeds right through four pages.
Did you actually sit and draw?
Yeah.
I mean, you did. You were filling it in.
I did.
It's embarrassing. Michael Jack is sitting and actually filling, but you did it.
Yeah, I did.
Colored books. Make sure you stayed inside the lines. The whole thing.
Yeah. That was not my proudest moment.
I think that's fine. I actually, you know what? I have to tell you, I thought about that. Maybe it's just a quiet thing for me to do, still my mind, give me something to focus on. I don't doodle anymore, but I know the doodle used to help me think. I just don't use paper. Okay, so you were doing it and you said, all right, I start to see some of the problem.
Yeah.
And it's not hard to frankly print out books, right? You can do that easily.
Well, it was actually harder than you might think because it was for us. We knew nothing about printing at the time. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't use any of the services that are out there. Like there's all these services like print on demand that make it really easy to create your own book and self-publish, but not with the spiral binding and not with the hardback cover and not with like special artist paper. So like these are all things that we had to go figure out, and we had no idea how to do it. We literally started calling the front desk of a printing press and trying to figure out how to make this happen. And we couldn't give them an example because it didn't exist yet.
You were doing it.
So my cousin is actually the face of the brand for Color It, and she was the one that was her responsibility. So she was making those phone calls.
And you guys own the business 50-50, or you hired her?
75-25.
75 for you.
Yep.
All right. And so now you're starting to get some traction, right?
Yeah, it was pretty fast. I mean, it was once we released it, we knew we had a hit. It actually became the problem, like a lot of entrepreneurs have, it became not, are we going to sell these? It was, how the hell are we going to fill all these orders? Like,
but how did you get people to come into your site?
Facebook ads.
That's it.
Yeah.
There wasn't podcast. A lot of blogging. You did have some blogging. Amazing.
But not at the time. I mean, when we first launched, it was all, nothing was there. I mean, now the site does really well from an SEO standpoint. We rank on the first page for like gel pens even, I mean, which is a pretty competitive word. But at the time it was, you know, it was a brand new site that had one book. So it was tough.
Okay. And that's when you finally start to get your mojo, create your own products, own your destiny, have it on a site, get good at SEO, all the stuff that you knew was now starting to come in.
Exactly. Yep.
At what point did you say we're going to start to document this process?
Actually, during the ice wraps phase, I was a member. There's a community called E-commerce Fuel, which anyone that's listening is in e-commerce, I highly recommend checking them out. A guy named Andrew Darian runs it. And I had found out about that somehow through like the grapevine of being on other forums or chat groups or whatever. And I joined that community and realized pretty quickly that it was interesting because like I felt like I was so far behind the curve, like, and I had so much to learn. And I still do for sure. And I did then. But like the technology component was something that like I realized when I joined that forum that I was ahead of the curve on by quite a lot.
What was the technology component that you were ahead of the curve on?
You know, being able to just run Shopify and design a store and conversion rate optimization and the search engine optimization part of it and the marketing, running Facebook
ads. People
didn't
know all that.
No. Yeah. I mean, most people find that to be overwhelming. Here's the thing that's interesting about our business versus most e-commerce entrepreneurs. Most e-commerce entrepreneurs are coming to it from, you know, I've got this widget that I invented and, or that I'm really passionate about, or this is like a family business that we've had for years. And I know about these products, but I know nothing about how to sell them online. And I came at it from a completely different angle. I came at it from I know how to do online marketing. I know online technology. I didn't know how to do e-commerce at the very beginning, but that was a very small leap from other things I was doing. And I was coming at it from a very analytical standpoint of this is what I want to sell for these following reasons. And because of that, I think that we had a leg up and we still do. And so when I go to speak at events and things of that nature, I'm usually still talking about that component because most people I've realized find that part to be overwhelming, where for me, it just comes naturally. And for me, you know, because there's always two sides of the coin. The thing that I struggle with is, you know, the products that we have, because it was a very analytical thing and not a passion thing, it makes it difficult. Like my passion is like making happy customers and being prideful of the products I make, but I don't color. At the end of the day, it is not the same feeling that I had when I was dealing with online poker. If you can understand like the idea there. Right. I mean, I lived and breathed online poker regardless. Every morning when I got up, I was going to go do that anyway. Like I own color. So it's a different angle.
I get it. All right. And so then how did you find the next product? Why didn't you say, what am I into? I'm into podcasting. Let's create a podcasting site. I'm into, you don't think that way. You think about where's the big revenue. If I don't love it, it's fine as long as there's a big group of people who do love it. Am I right?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, the reason I didn't get into some of the stuff you just mentioned there, one of the things I struggle with in other parts of my entrepreneurial life is like, you want to get into everything. Like you get into, like you chase two rabbits, both get away. It's kind of like the saying. So I was like, you know what? Like I need to stay focused on e-commerce. Like this is the thing that I'm doing. And if I get off on one of these other tangents, it's just going to be bad for everybody. So we've continued to focus on e-commerce in every way. So it's, yes, we have more than one brand, but like the reason we got into more brands is because we ran out of products to sell for the other brands. You know, there's only so many coloring products you can offer. So we had to come up with another brand.
What was the next brand?
The next one after that, we actually launched two basically at the same time, which was Wild Baby and Tactical.com. And that has a e-commerce brand with it as well. So
I thought Tactical was the biggest one before we talked. And then you set me straight when we were chatting. I said, look, I'm not seeing a lot of traffic for it. How could this be your biggest brand? You said, it's not. What is the biggest?
So from a dollar volume, it's Ice Wraps. It's basically like an order of how we started, right? So like Ice Wraps is the first. So it has the biggest volume by far. Then Color It, you know, another seven-figure brand. Wild Baby, definitely not a seven-figure brand yet. And other is Tactical, but they will be.
I get Tactical. I've actually taught, there's a guy in my audience. He probably doesn't want me to mention his name. He doesn't like attention. He's doing really well with the, so what is it called? So not survivalists, the stuff
Survivalism.
For,
like so prepping, homesteading. Yeah,
for prepping. It's shocking how many people believe the world is going to end or that the country's going to go through a big issue and they want to prepare. Yeah. And it's shocking how unprepared I am. I should be.
Yeah.
I'm in San Francisco, earthquake city.
Yeah.
But I get it. What I don't understand then is Wild Baby. There's so many sites for babies. How do you compete in that space, dude?
It's tough. And quite frankly, it's kind of the least interesting brand within our company now. These are some things that we kind of, we launched Wild Baby and Tactical at the same time. I wanted to like float a couple of trial balloons out there and see what would happen from a marketing perspective. The idea was the next brand that we really take all the way down the path and really focus on, and we didn't really know what that was going to be. We wanted it to have basically like an unlimited depth of SKUs. So like baby, you can do like an unlimited number of products, so we think with Tactical.
Oh, got it. Yeah. Because with coloring books, there are only so many products you could have. But when it comes to babies, there's an infinite amount of stuff that you could get for babies. Like, look at this on your site. I'm a dad. We've just gone through this period. So everything here makes sense to me. I never saw a striped kid's poncho. And the kid looks cute in it. Makes sense. Yeah. I don't know if I can get my kid to wear it, but I like it a lot. So you're saying, look, if you could get to the poncho level for toddlers who can barely stand up, there's a big market here. And that's what you were going for.
And we also wanted to be able to take what we learned from Color It and apply that to the next thing. So again, a direct Facebook audience, you can advertise to people who have kids. Mm. You can sell them more than one thing. I mean, kids have a tendency to continue to grow and, you know, need more clothes, more toys, whatever. But we are struggling with that brand, quite frankly. I mean, it's not the same response and success that we've gotten with Tactical. So we're going to be focusing. We do not have kids.
Yeah, I get that sense from this, that this is from someone who understands kids without actually having them.
Yep. No, I mean, there's definitely a lot to that, right? I mean, but I understand the tactical.
There's something that's telling me that. There's something that's spot on and still, I don't know.
We do have someone that works with us that does have a kid. Julia is like our friend that lives in Guatemala. A lot of this stuff is sourced down there because we were looking at fair trade products. But what we've determined after, you know, doing this now for a year, kind of side by side, is the older demographic is kind of like what we've excelled at now, like the 45 plus people, because they, I mean, this is going to sound awful, but it's the truth. They fall for the marketing gimmicks easier, right? I mean, like a younger millennial sophisticated, you know, they're more sophisticated online. They don't like really buy into like the giveaways or the contest or free plus shipping offers and all these things.
More jaded, more cynical, less willing to do this stuff. Yeah, that makes sense.
So we've struggled with the marketing tactics that we've had success with on Wild Baby because of that. And with Tactical, because it's typically an older audience, the same exact tactics that have brought us success with Color It have worked incredibly well with Tactical.
Okay. I get that. How do you compete now in a world with Amazon when you're doing e-commerce? Part of it is you're jumping on Amazon, right?
We do sell on Amazon. On there. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I want to learn from you. I know what I know.
I was just going to say, like, when we started in e-commerce, we were 100% off Amazon. And we've now turned into this, like, 85% Amazon behemoth. You know, Amazon continues to grow at a faster rate than anything that I can do off Amazon, like, no matter how hard I try. It's good and bad. It's good from the perspective of to get sales on Amazon requires significantly less staff and effort because the traffic's already there. Like people are already looking for these products on Amazon. The downside is a very similar situation we have with online poker. We're ending up in this too many of our eggs are in one basket situation that makes me uncomfortable. So like, that means that in any moment, Amazon could completely wipe our business out. Good, bad, and different, how that might happen. But
lots of different ways, right? They could create a house. They take the thing that works best for you, turn it into a house brand, stick a few people on it, and suddenly they're selling it.
Yes.
They decide that this works so well. In fact, they don't even have to decide anything. I've interviewed people who have software that helps other people find out what's selling well on Amazon, and then they just jump in. I've interviewed some entrepreneurs who do well, who say, please don't reveal what products are doing well because people are going to go to Amazon, they hear my revenue, and they're going to copy me, all that stuff. And so that's where you are. How are you even producing that kind of net margin when you're on Amazon where it's super competitive?
I mean, they're still very viable products. I mean, the net margins, I don't think they're that great. I mean, but e-commerce, you know, to be in the 10 to 15% range is pretty typical. You completely net all in net margin. That's where things fall out. I mean, we don't sell for less than that. We're not going to race to the bottom. We make higher quality products. We don't chase a race to the bottom with a quality thing. So, I mean, our products in general are 4.5 stars and above, and they rank well because we don't get a lot of returns. There's a lot of things that factor into Amazon's algorithm. It's a complicated process, but the business definitely works, and to the tune of $8 million in sales this year.
You know, let's get some advice for you from someone who's for someone who's in the audience. Let's suppose there's someone in my audience who's selling fanny packs. Apparently, that's a thing. Right? Selling it on their own website. Is
generational, right? That comes back and it goes and comes back.
And you know what the truth is? I don't like fanny packs. I don't want to carry anything, but I'd love for them to come in because they're so practical. Okay. So and frankly, I'm not going to carry them even if they are practical. I want to be minimalist, as little as possible. Let's suppose that's a thing. Someone's selling it on a Shopify store. Hard to get traffic, but fine. They're doing okay. They're selling on Amazon. That's where they get most of their traffic, but it's pretty competitive. They're getting a little clever by creating different designs for their fanny packs. They're selling more, but they're not making huge, huge impact. They want more money. What would you recommend they do to get more attention for their site so they could sell and have more impact to sell on Amazon? Let's take them as a proxy for other people who are in e-commerce in my audience.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Fanny packs is a challenging one because it might be something people aren't very passionate about, right? So, I mean, the things that we've had success with are things that people would want to tell others about. And fanny packs is kind of like on that line because like it is a kind of a fashionable thing. So like they might kind of Instagram about it or tell their friends or people can visibly see that they're wearing it. So I mean, if I was going to be getting into that niche, the first thing I would be mapping out is thinking about like who are the influencers and the players in that space and be looking at their products and looking at all the competitors, getting them in, fully understanding, just like we did with Coloring Book, like what can we do to improve the product in that space? Like not just make the same thing over and over again, especially if there's anything you can copyright, trademark, or get some sort of IP edge in your favor. We've done that with a lot of the things that we've done, especially for Color It.
Beyond Color It, what are you able to lock in that way?
So all the designs immediately are copyrighted, any of the pages.
So if I put a design on my fanny pack, that's mine now.
Yes.
Make sure I create my own.
Interesting that you mentioned that. On clothing, this is like the one niche that doesn't apply to. So if I make a t-shirt design, you can't copyright that. I don't know if that applies to a fanny pack or not, but it definitely does for a coloring book. But maybe it's a patent on the clips that hold the strap together or the way that the zipper works. Maybe it's like the zipper when you shut it, like somehow it can't be opened easily, so some thief can't like open it and steal something out of it easily. Something that would differentiate yourself that you could apply some sort of design patent to or copyright or some. You'd have to talk to a lawyer, but like make sure you understand something you can get some IP edge on. So it isn't just easily copied. You're still going to have to play whack-a-mole with people that are going to want to do it anyway. But if you can make something that's different and better and people understand that and have value in that difference, you're going to have a much better chance for success than if you just go to Alibaba and buy the same fanny pack because like for the most part, most of the stuff that's on Amazon is an exact copy of the other stuff that's already on Amazon.
And so when you do it, would you look at the other Amazon reviews for other fanny packs to see what people don't like about it? Would you look to see what people are excited about? Would you call up customers? Or for you, is it more about gut and instinct?
Looking at other reviews is 100% of the part of the process that we go through. And when I was talking about like how we knew how to improve coloring books, that was one of the things that I did do. I read through hundreds, if not thousands of reviews of a whole bunch of coloring books to see what people were complaining about.
What were they complaining about?
The biggest stuff that we saw coming up over and over again was double-sided printing, was the spiral binding, like the book not laying flat.
Right.
And so those are the things that we decided to work on.
So Got it. That does make sense. So you're sitting down, looking at Amazon, seeing what people are complaining about, finding a way to create a better version of it and selling. Are you running late? I know we're going a little bit over our time.
I'm good enough to, I didn't realize we could take a break. So, but I am running. I don't have a key to lock up. Can I have just 1 second to make sure
that the key to lock up?
Yeah. I don't have a key in my own office.
Go ahead.
let me just make sure. I can stay for longer. I just need to make sure.
Okay. We won't go much longer. Okay. Speaking of poker, go ahead. No, you go ahead. I'll just talk to the audience. We're not editing anything out. I'm going to keep on going. I am doing poker. Now my kids are 4 and 2. I used to do poker night here in San Francisco all the freaking time. In fact, even in Santa Monica. Now the kids are a little bit older. They're going to go to sleep. And I'm doing poker tonight. I invited some people over. I ended up with 16 people in my house. That's not the size poker game that I usually like to do. We'll see how that happens. I've been doing Scotch night again. So if you guys are coming into town, let me know about Scotch night. Doing it, inching my way towards it. I used to do it every single Thursday, but I think I can't get to that point. And for me, a lot of it is to just get to know people who are in San Francisco. I love that when I have a question about a guest, I could ping somebody and get some feedback on them. I didn't do this with you, Michael, but I had a couple of questions about other guests. I love that I could find somebody in my network because I do poker here in San Francisco. I can ping them and say, hey, give me some insight into this guy. Give me some info about that guy. Tell me about how it's working here. Tell me about that. It's incredibly, incredibly helpful. So that's why I was saying that I do poker here, and tonight I'm doing poker in San Francisco.
Nice.
Next week I'm doing poker again in my house.
Don't invite me to your game. Be a bad, big mistake.
You know what? I think you'd be bored.
I'm kidding.
I intentionally do it to bore people like you. I try to get my buy-ins to be $5 buy-ins. Let the competitive spirit be the thing that keeps people engaged, but yeah, not so much that they get distracted. Where do you live?
San Diego.
San Diego. All right. I'm not doing poker down there, but I'll do Scotch night over there later. In a few months, whenever I'm invited to an event, I do Scotch night at the event. I get awesome. The biggest suite I can get. Do Scotch night. I'd love to see
it. I would love to join you for that. That would be awesome.
Yeah, there you go. We were talking about how you then started to read the Amazon reviews, look at the issues, create products, and then, I love that story. Tell me this. How much are you doing in the coloring business? How much in revenue?
It's like going to be this year 2.5 to 3.
And then that seems like a high profit business.
It's better than ice wraps for sure. Yeah.
What's the profit on that?
It's probably on the higher, like on the 15% edge versus the 10. Yeah. I mean,
ice wraps definitely. I thought that'd be even more because it's just
on the net profit. So we have a lot more. Well, I don't know like how much it's so hard to measure some of this marketing stuff, right? So like we put a lot more effort with color into marketing than we do with ice wraps.
Okay.
Ice wraps is a very much more commoditized product and there's not a lot we can improve. On the color side, we put more in the effort of marketing by sharing more user-generated content, creating more Facebook ads, writing more content. So we end up with expenses that are hard to measure directly, but we kind of have a sense of the halo effect we get by writing some of that content. And some of it you keep doing just because you're scared if we stop doing it, what the negative effect could be like down the road. I mean, like what happens if we start? We do this thing every week called Color It Live, which is a weekly Facebook Live that we've done for the last like 2 years. We're at episode like 100 and something. What if we stop doing that? You know, what? There's a couple hundred people that come every week. If we stop doing that, like how much does our sales go down? Like how much does it hurt like the core community of our members that are probably the ones that are doing the word of mouth advertising for us on our behalf? And they kind of just, you know, fade away. So it's just that there's a lot of things that you can't directly measure, but you get a sense that they're worth it, but there's definitely an expense to doing that stuff. So, you know, we could get our net margins up for sure in a short amount of time, but then what's like the long-term effect of that? Like when and how does it affect the top line? It's hard to know.
Why are you doing Ecom Crew? You don't look like a guy who needs attention. I need attention. That's why I'm doing this.
Everyone loves attention, right?
I don't know. A lot of people don't.
I'm definitely not
going to have a hole in their heart that needs to be filled by other people paying attention to them.
I'm gonna give you the honest answer. That's going to sound like BS because I know when I say this, it sounds like BS. But you know, when I was doing online poker, the environment was you couldn't tell anybody at any time about anything you were doing because they would stab you in the back or steal your idea. Everybody was going after the exact same thing, the exact same term. Everybody wanted to rank for online poker. And e-commerce, it's like this multi-trillion-dollar behemoth of an industry. even if somebody were to compete against me selling coloring books or ice packs or baby clothing or tactical gear, I'm never going to have 100% of any one of those niches. I don't profess to even try to do that. And if you can listen to my advice, and the only thing you're going to do is like copy the product that I'm doing and try to compete with me, if I let you beat me, I feel like that's my fault. But the genuine thing is that, like, I love helping people. Like, it's the same reason I do a lot of other things in my own personal life to help people and do things. It's a really gratifying feeling when someone walks up to me and says, like, you've changed my life, like, for the better. Like, you've changed our business. You saved our business. You helped me quit my job and do something else. It's really flipping cool. And it doesn't negatively impact me in any way, shape, or form any business that I do. It's a pretty unique spot to be able to do that. And that's why I do it, like, wholeheartedly. It feels good. I mean, there's a lot of science behind, it feels really good to help others. I mean, you hear that stuff a lot, like a lot of these cliche sayings, and it's been true. It really has.
Yeah. You do one-on-ones with people too, who join your program. I don't have much info about your program, but I'm doing some research now as we're talking, and I could see that Andrew from E-commerce Fuel vouches for you guys, and you do one-on-one sessions, and you're teaching a lot. What's the number one?
A P tape on Andrew though, so that doesn't really count.
Oh, really? No, he'd probably be okay with that. He would publish. I had him on Mixergy. I thought it was really interesting that in his group, he said, "I'm going to limit access to my group to people who earn a certain amount of money," and then he just kept upping it. Right?
Yeah.
So if you want to be an e-commerce fool, you got to pay. You got to earn a certain amount. For you guys, there's no minimum or maximum, right?
No, we haven't capped it on either side.
So the people who come in, there's got to be one or two things that they all come in, mistakes that they come in making that you help them fix.
Really, really wide range of stuff that we've helped people with. I mean, some people are coming in as complete neophytes, and it's like, I'm just overwhelmed. Like, what label goes on what part of, like, the product, like on the product, the case, the pallets. I mean, it just getting started on Amazon.
What goes on the pallets? They're at that level.
There's pallet labels.
And you're helping with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, whatever questions people have, we help them. That's part of the subscription that we do.
And manufacturing, you guys help them find the right place.
All that, helping them pick a niche, helping them find the manufacturer, how to do inspections.
You go and inspect your factory? No, inspect the product that comes in.
Well, I mean, we don't actually do that for them. We just tell them, here's the company.
No, I mean your product. You're actually going out there and, like, the baby equipment.
For sure. Yeah, I personally don't. We hire a company that goes and does that.
Yeah. They go to China. They look at the factory on your behalf. They make sure that things are good. And then you take possession of, say, the baby products?
We take possession after the inspection's been done, and we approve the order. Yeah.
Okay. And then you look at it, you actually have somebody go in and make sure that everything's the way it's supposed to be.
Correct. Yep.
All right. For anyone who wants to go check you out, it's ecomcrew.com. It's also Terran. What does Terran mean?
So Terran just, it means human race or whatever. It's also a race in StarCraft. I get asked that that's what it came from originally. It is not. I wanted a short, one more domain name to make our conglomerate. And it's just cool to have Terran, 6 letters. That doesn't mean a lot.
Terran.com. It just happens to have some meaning, but for you, it's just
a holding company. Like, no one ever goes there. The only time we ever really send anybody there is when we're hiring. We have, like, a little about us page and make it look like a legitimate company, even though we're a complete shit show behind the scenes. But
let me see. Did I look you guys up on Glassdoor? I don't think I thought to do that. I was really obsessed with your traffic. I was trying to get a sense of whether you guys are doing, I don't know how to confirm your revenue. How can
I can send you my taxes.
Done. Where are you going to send it?
I probably wouldn't send my tax. I probably would send my P&L, but we're definitely going to hit 8 million this year.
All right. Thanks so much for doing this interview. And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first is a company that will help you hire if there's anything that you guys need. I'm telling you, Michael, it's going to stick in your head. At some point, you're going to go to them. TopTal, TOPTAL, toptal.com/Mixergy. And for hosting, almost everyone at this point knows HostGator. I don't even know why they're paying me, but they just re-upped for next year, bought even more ads.
Awesome.
So it must be doing well.
They really are good.
They really are good, and I know they look at their numbers all the time, and I know they see how long Mixergy people sticking around. Are they actually signing up or whatever? I'm glad they're coming in. They and TopTal in for big, but Sachit, who sells our ads, said, "We do not want to be dependent on any one big advertiser, even if they want to buy more ads, we're going to start to look for other advertisers. And so he's got a bunch of advertisers. I love that the dude's like super fired up. He called me up yesterday. Andrew, you got to hear all the sponsors. We got a bunch of them. But TopTal and HostGator are coming in for the most because they've been doing so well. So if you're listening and you want some social proof, I guess I don't have it. All I can have is, look, they're not buying a bunch of ads from us unless it's working for our audience. TopTal.com/MixerG. Michael, thanks. I'm glad that we got to meet each other.
Definitely. It was a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for having me on.
You bet. Thanks. Bye, everyone.